Hello everyone, my name is Mike Resler and I'm a product strategy specialist for Veeam Software. My focus is around technologies like Hyper-V and System Center. I've been doing this already for many years and I've been presenting on a large event such as Microsoft Management Summit, the TechEd and several Tech Days in many different countries. I am a Microsoft MVP in the System Center Cloud and Data Center technology since 2010. And if you want to do me a favor and you're having something to drink with me, then discussing disaster recovery scenarios is one of my favorite things to do. Let's have a look at our agenda. So what we got today is we're going to talk about, of course, Windows Server 2012 R2, what's new. But before we do that, we're going to have a quick look at what the trends in IT world are and what Microsoft actually means with the cloud OS. So after we talked about the trends and why Microsoft talks about the cloud OS, which actually means something more than just a marketing term, we're also going to look at the overview. We're going to talk about file service and storage, networking, clustering, Hyper-V, Windows PowerShell, Windows Deployment Service, Directory Services, and Security. So let's get this thing going. So let's start first with the trends. If you look at the trends today in IT, then you will notice that you're really in the middle of a transformation. The way we used to work with IT, the way we did it for many years, client server and so on, they kind of, it's changing. We are not here that, not there yet to the new method we all want, but we are really getting close. And one of the big things you have to remember is that everything is starting to evolve around compute, storage, and network. Virtualization is a big driver here. Very cool. But this is something which we're working to. But we also see at the same time that there's a huge data explosion. Now, I know that we are saying this already for years, but lately, the last year, the last 2 years, we really see a lot more data coming at us, and we need to be able to handle that. Not only store it somewhere, but also to work with that data. We also see more and more consumerization of IT. Now, bring your own device is certainly not yet something which is used everywhere, but on the other hand, what we do see, and I am one of these guys, I own a laptop, which isn't even the main joint to my company. I've got two tablets, I've got a cell phone, and I've got some other toys that I use during all my travel. And whatever toy I'm using at that moment, I want to make sure that I can access my data, that I can do some work. We also see that today when you develop applications, that something has changed. It doesn't have to be an application anymore. It needs to be social. The patterns of that application are changing. And last but not least, again, it is maybe a marketing term, but we see the rise of cloud computing. And cloud computing, that is exactly why Microsoft is building now Windows Server 2012 and just released Windows Server 2012 R2, and that is why they call it the cloud OS. Very important here, let me quickly jump to my pointer here, is that you look at this picture. And this picture actually shows you the customer, which is you, your own IT department, your own servers, your data center, which is on-site at your place. And then you got the service provider, and this could be a hoster which lives in the same street or the same city, or you know, some guys that you know that give you some access to some computing, to some storage, to some network. And then you got cloud platforms such as Windows Azure in the case of Microsoft, but of course we got Amazon as an example as well here. Now, important here with the cloud OS is that Microsoft's vision is that all these three little pieces have to be one consistent platform. And I'm going to tell you something here. Some of you might already know it, otherwise will maybe not believe me, but it is true. If you're going to deploy Windows Server 2012 R2 at your own site, then know that within Windows Azure, it is also Windows Server 2012 R2 that is running. It's the exact same code, the exact same bits. Also, your service provider living in your street or in your city can be using Windows Server 2012 R2. So what Microsoft want to reach and what they mean by the cloud OS is that you have the ability to deploy your operating system the way you want and the way it fits within your environment, but on the other hand, that it can be deployed everywhere in Azure or within your service provider, and that you have one consistent platform, meaning that your developers, for example, won't need to develop an application twice. It can be deployed at your site, it can be deployed at Azure, it can be deployed with the service provider. And that is the idea of the Cloud OS. All right, let's have a look at Windows Server 2012 R2 overview. You have to think that about a year ago, a little bit more, Microsoft has announced and brought general available Windows Server 2012. And that was a huge difference from those who were working with Windows Server 2008 R2. It was kind of a big revolution. I am one of those guys that had to jump from Windows Server NT to Windows Server 2000. And at that time, we were saying, oh my God, it is so different. It's so difficult to do. This is not going to work well. Well, 2008 R2 jumped to 2012, and what we saw was the exact same reaction. Whoa, so many changes, so many new stuff, but how are we going to handle this? And now we are 1 year further, and R2 is general available. That means that Microsoft really put a lot of work in 1 year, because they didn't make R2 just a small update, or bug fixes, or maybe something like, you know, a service pack. No, they really put a lot of new stuff within R2. And let's have a look at all of the different things that are there. We're going to start with file services and storage. All right. First thing you need to learn is work folders. And this has to do with bring your own device. Or maybe choose your own device, depending on what kind of things you're working. I already told you I got some tablets. I want to be able to reach the files on the file servers within the company. Well, work folders is exactly that. It gives you the possibility to use whatever device, Android, iOS device, or Windows RT for that matter, and it gives you that ability to connect to a specific file server. Now, somebody of you is going to say, well, you know, we already have this kind of technology. Well, you're right. But here's the big difference. Now imagine that something goes wrong with the end user, his device, or, you know, the end user just decides to quit. At that moment, you as an IT guy, you want to make sure that you can delete all that corporate data from whatever device he's using. Well, if he's using those devices and they are workplace connected and using work folders, at that moment, you can actually delete all the corporate data without touching the end user's data. So imagine that I leave my company Veeam today, then the guys at the office would be able to delete all the corporate data of my Windows RT device, and at the same time all my personal pictures and movies and music and whatever else is running on that device will stay there and will not be removed. So this is pretty cool technology, and it works in both ways. You as an end user, you can also decide to unsubscribe from such a work folder. And at the same time, you as an IT professional, you know that that data will be secure on those devices. Pretty cool new technology that we have, and kind of a response to of Microsoft to end users starting to use Dropbox or SkyDrive Home or something like that. Now, in Windows Server 2012, they introduced SMB 3.0. And SMB 3.0, certainly for the smaller companies, was really a blessing. Finally, we got a good SMB transport protocol that allowed us, for example, to run virtual machines on it. That means that end users or smaller customers didn't have to make that large investments to build, for example, a Hyper-V cluster within their own premise. Now, 2012 R2 will, of course, keep SMB 3.0, but there are some improvements as well. One of the things, for example, is that you now can do automatic rebalancing of scale-out file server clients. There's also a huge improved performance of SMB Direct. SMB Direct, better known by some of you as SMB over RDMA, is now improved that it works well for smaller I/O workloads, like little files being copied all the time. And that improvement will be seen a lot when you use high-speed network interfaces like 40 gigabits Ethernet, or if you got the money, 56 gigabits InfiniBand. You asked for it, Microsoft delivered. One of the complaints, and you will see that a couple of times in this presentation, was, well, you know, we need to troubleshoot SMB, but we see some stuff in the event viewer, but it tells us nothing. Well, now what they did is make sure that those event messages have much more detailed and helpful information so that you can actually start troubleshooting your SMB issues. One of the things that I'll already mention here within SMB, but I'm going to come back to that later on when we talk about clustering, is that now you can use a VHDX file as shared storage for guest clustering. That means that you can build a virtual SQL cluster, for example, on your Hyper-V cluster and share a VHDX file. But again, I'm going to come back over that. One of the new features is the possibility to use SMB3 as your transport protocol for live migration. Now, imagine that your infrastructure is taking advantage of things like SMB Direct and SMB Multichannel, and we'll be seeing those things more and more with the newer hardware, then you will get actually high-speed migration, and it actually won't be using a lot of CPU. So that is also pretty cool. Now, you can also do some SMB bandwidth management. Depending on the workload you're sending over your SMB channel, or maybe multiple channels, you can configure specific bandwidth limits for that. Now, there are three types today. You've got the default, which you are using in Windows Server 2012 as well. But in R2, now you can choose to put it at live migration or virtual machine. So if you're running virtual machines over your SMB channels, then you put it at virtual machine to optimize those bandwidth. And if you're live doing your live migrations over that channel, then you can change it to live migration. Last but not least, which I certainly want to say, if you in your environment don't have any older SMB clients anymore, like XP or older, or Windows Server 2003 and older, now you can actually uninstall or remove SMB 1.0. Now, why would you want to do that? Very simple. If you remove it, that means you will need to patch less and you've got less security risk as well. So again, something that you should look at your own environment. All right, and we're going to continue now in the storage section and the file services. And one of the things that has a few changes as well is DFS namespace and DFS replication. To start with, and this is something you will hear me say again a lot of the times during this presentation, it is now fully PowerShell supported. So that's pretty cool. If you have automation needs, you have now PowerShell to manage your DFS namespace and replication. Another thing that has is that the DFS replication WMI provider has been redesigned. Now, on the one hand, this is good news. On the other hand, if you already have some automation and scripts inside your environment based on WMI providers, then you might want to check whether your scripts still are going to work when you decide to upgrade to R2. So this is certainly something to remember before you do your upgrades. A few other improvements is that you now can clone the database for your initial synchronization. This is good, because if you got one server on one side of the world and the other server on the other side of the world, now you don't need to put the initial synchronization of the database over that one line. Now you can do it with a clone and then do the final synchronization afterwards. Other improvements that you will see with the database, for example, is that when it gets corrupted, it used to be so that you kind of had to do everything all over again. Now it can recover from that and only send over the changes that have been done since corruption. One of the other things that I want to talk about is cross-file RDC disable. Cross-file remote differential compression. Now, by default, this is on. And this is good when you are doing DFS replication over a WAN environment. But if your replication servers are on the same LAN, then, you know, it's maybe not the best option. Now you can disable it, which means that you will have performance improvements for those replication servers, but it will increase the bandwidth uses. So depending on if you're replicating over a LAN, then disabling it will be a good idea. If you're doing it over a WAN, then you probably prefer to have it on. Other changes in previous operating systems, DFS replications always used a hard code 256 kilobit file size to determine the staging requirements. So this is, you know, tuning your file staging. Now it's not necessary anymore. Now you can choose that file staging size yourself. You can choose, you know, between 256 kilobyte to 512 terabyte, depending on your needs to increase the performance. Now I do hope that nobody wants to size a file over 512 terabyte, but as you can see, you have the possibility. When you have files that are in the hidden DFS private folders, the conflict and deleted and the pre-existing folders, used to be so, recovering these files, well, you know, wasn't really possible. R2, because of PowerShell, you can get those back by using get DFS preserved files and restore DFSR preserved files commandlets. Now, don't worry, I didn't know these commandlets out of my head. They are written on a little paper in front of me, but think about it that you can use those. Let's see, what else have we got? iSCSI target server. Now, for those of you who have never used this, iSCSI target allows Windows Server to share some block storage remotely. The cool thing about this is iSCSI, it just uses your Ethernet network. That means you don't require additional or specialized, expensive hardware. Now, it used to be so that it was a separate download in Windows Server 2008 R2. Then in Windows Server 2012, it was already included. And now with R2, there are some major changes. One of the changes is that the data persistence layer is completely redesigned. It's not based on VHD format anymore. It's based on the VHDX format, which is, of course, a big improvement because now it can use the improvements of the VHDX format over the VHD. There are some new manageability enhancements. For example, those who are working with Virtual Machine Manager, they know that there's something called SMIS that you need to manage your storage straight from Virtual Machine Manager. Well, if you got iSCSI Target Server today, then you will see that it is supported now with SMIS, meaning that you can use Virtual Machine Manager to actually start creating LUNs and that kind of stuff on your iSCSI Target block storage. It also has got completely new PowerShell commandlets and so on. And also an improvement in scalability. If you look at the maximum number of sessions, it's now increased to 544 per target server, and the maximum number of logical units is increased to 256. On the other hand, I do hope that you don't have 256 LUNs attached to one target server. One last thing I do want to say is that the local mount functionality has been removed. In Windows Server 2012 R2, you won't be able to locally mount snapshots anymore. Now, there is a workaround. You can use the local iSCSI initiator or the loopback initiator, as most of us will call it, to access to those exported snapshots, but it is a workaround. So if something in your production environment is based on that ability to mount those snapshots, think about it, because that you will lose in R2 and you will need to find a better solution for that. Let's look at storage spaces. Storage spaces is technology that, you know, gives you the possibility to bring together physical disks and build virtual disks on top of that. For smaller shops, this technology actually gives you a very cheap way to create shared storage. Now, we have seen a lot of interest to that solution. You know, because in the end, in Windows Server 2012, if you look at it, it was kind of the same thing with a real storage area network or a SAN is doing. Only the difference is, of course, the price. And the fact that with Windows Server 2012, you didn't have the same functionality yet. Because now with R2, there are some new functionality. One of this is called tiered storage spaces. That means you can create the storage space by mixing fast disks, the more expensive ones, and slower disks, the cheaper ones. This will give you just a LUN with much bigger capacity, and yet you will still have performance on the fast disk. Now the cool thing here is that Windows Server 2012 R2 will do an analysis on those storage spaces. It will be default at 1 a.m. in the morning, but you can change that to whatever hour you want. And it will place, you know, files or used part of files that are used a lot, like which we call hot blocks. It will put those on the fast tier. Now the parts that you don't use a lot, the cold blocks, will be placed on the capacity tier or on the slower disk. And this is fully automated and done for you. But it gets better. Windows Server 2012 R2 can actually leverage one of those fast tier disks to tackle large write activity. Let me explain this. Let's say we take Hyper-V as an example. Now Hyper-V requires write through to make sure that you have no data loss. You don't want to make sure that whatever happens in your virtual machine that it doesn't get lost. Now the problem with this, because it needs to do that, that means that you have reduced write performance. And especially when you got some virtual machine that has a lot of write activity. Think a SQL server running in a virtual machine, for example. Now, by using the fast tier storage at this moment, by leveraging when there is at a certain moment a large write activity, the performance can be really improved here, which is of course something good. And there are also some more resiliency options, which means you've got some more possibilities to build, you know, like RAID technology on that storage space, so if one disk or more disks goes down, you don't lose any data. Then we're going to talk about data deduplication, and this will be the last topic on file services and storage before we jump to networking. Data deduplication in Windows Server 2012 was already very, very good. Well, here are a few improvements. From R2, data deduplication will be supported on VDIs. Now, if you think about it, that means if it's supported for VDIs, that means it's supported for shared cluster shared volumes, CSVs. It also means that it now works with open files. And besides that, they also improved a little bit of the algorithms, which makes sure that your read-write performance and your optimization performance has been improved. Now here's a nice thing which we saw. When we have, for example, 40 VDI machines running on a CSV on a couple of Hyper-V hosts. Now, because data deduplication uses caching, all the hot blocks are placed in cache. Now, one of the issues with VDI is what we call the boot storm in the morning when everybody got his first coffee and they all want to start their VDI at the same time. Now, because of this caching mechanism, and 90% of an operating system is actually all the same code, that means all of that code or all of those hot blocks will be within that cache. Because it's a fast memory, that means you will see that your VDIs will boot much faster when they run on data deduplication than when they don't run on deduplication. First, some small changes to DHCPs. Not that many, but one of the things is that now your policies within DHCP are extended so you can create conditions based on the fully qualified domain name of clients. This also means that your DHCP policies now can be configured to register DHCP clients using a specific DNS suffix, overriding the DNS suffix used on the client. Now this is pretty cool because this is again something which you can use within that bring your own device or workplace, because you know my tablet probably doesn't even have a DNS suffix, but when I register on the network, now I can get a specific DNS suffix from my company so I can do my work. Another thing is that there is some changes in the registration options for DNS pointer records. It used to be so if somebody tried to register his DNS or his resource record with the DNS server, that you got a lot of failures within your event viewer if there wasn't a reverse lookup zone for that specific pointer resource record. Now, this is something you can avoid now, so that means your event viewer won't be filling up. This can be done for every client, or can also be done for clients that are on a specific subnet, or maybe a client with a specific attribute like iOS as operating system or something, or are within a specific VLAN. And last but not least, all the PowerShell command lines for DHCP are updated, which means that you have now again more possibilities to do automation as well. Some small changes to your DNS servers. Those who are running Windows Server 2012, they probably know that you already have some statistics. If you use Get DNS Server Statistics in PowerShell, then you can get statistics from your DNS server like cache statistics, memory statistics, record statistics, error statistics, and many, many more. In R2, this has been improved, and now you will get the zone query, the zone transfer, and the zone update statistics as well. So pretty cool stuff if you need to troubleshoot certain issues between zones. And also something, the DNSSEC or the Domain Name System Security extensions is now in better supported than before. For those of you that don't know what it is, it's kind of a suite of extensions that gives additional security to the DNS protocol. It uses digital signatures, it uses cryptographic keys to validate that the DNS response that your servers are getting or your clients are getting are authentic and real. So if now somebody, if you, you know, implement the solution and somebody is trying to send fake DNS responses to your clients, they won't take that anymore. And again, PowerShell enhancements as well. Okay, let's talk about IPAM. In Windows Server 2012, there was, you know, the introduction of a new feature called IPAM or IP Address Management. This was something that really caught my attention quickly. Not only because it was completely new, but if you look at IP management, it is one of the most difficult things to manage in an environment. Now, companies that have a little bit more money or are a bit larger in size will use something like Infoblox, which is a great, great solution. But unfortunately, for smaller shops, it's quite expensive. So IPAM could fill in that gap for the smaller shops. Unfortunately, as usual, the first version of Microsoft of IPAM wasn't that easy to install. Luckily, a lot has changed, and now in R2 they made it much more easier to install and give you some more improvements. One of the things is you can use now role-based access control. That means you can use roles, access scopes, access policies to manage control to IPAM. So your administrators in Belgium will all be able to manage the IPs within that country, and the guys from the USA will maintain everything over the USA, and then probably you will have somewhere a super administrator team that is possible to manage every IP. One of the things we saw also with the release of System Center 2012 is that we learned something which is called a virtual network and the management of the network as a fabric within virtual machine management. Now with the upcoming, well it is there actually, with the existing Virtual Machine Manager 2012 R2 and Windows Server 2012 R2, those two will be integrated. And IPAM will give the administrators to the possibility to manage not only the physical IP address space, but also the virtual IP address space. So this is also something new. There are some new views as well for DHCP, so we got some more possibilities to view data over your what your DHCPs are doing in your environment. And probably the coolest thing is, IPAM in Windows Server 2012 only was able to use an internal Microsoft database, but now you can actually deploy it on SQL support. And then yes, if you're asking, I'm already running IPAM, I got this internal database, can I migrate to a SQL server? Yes, that's perfectly possible. And of course, PowerShell as well is included. Now this sounds of course something you have been hearing the last 30 minutes already. Let's have a quick look at the Hyper-V Virtual Switch. With the introduction of the Hyper-V Virtual Switch in Windows Server 2012, Microsoft made a very important step toward networking private, hybrid, cloud environments. Now, there's some new functionality in R2. Besides, you already could create rules based on source, destination, MAC, IP addresses. Now you can actually create some rules on port number as well. One of the things you have to know is that network virtualization in Windows Server 2012 uses network virtualization generic routing encapsulation, or NVGRE. VR2, now you have the possibility to allow third-party forward extensions working together with that NVGRE. And this is very good because now you can forward packets to, you know, the virtual machine customer address within your virtual network space, but also use another solution to then forward or route those IPs to a physical address space. So you can have that routing and that data flowing between your different clouds, your private clouds, your hybrid, or your Azure environments. Also pretty cool is that in Windows Server 2012, there was something called RSS over SRIOV, RSS meaning receive side scaling. And this was pretty cool because it took the load that off your CPU that it needed to calculate networking. Now, what we saw at that moment was you had less problems with your networking on your host level, but if you kind of donated the 10 gigabit network port to one of your virtual machines, then you saw that the virtual CPU couldn't handle it and you were never able to use that bandwidth within that virtual machine. In R2, what we see now is there's something called virtual RSS or VRSS, which you can place or activate on the virtual machine network path. And that should improve the guest networking because, you know, now that processing load will be handled by the network path and it won't give you any issues anymore on your virtual CPU. And then something you asked, and Microsoft really listened here, and they had to listen on this one, trying to solve your virtualization network was very, very difficult in 2012. In R2, network traces will give you the switch configuration, the port configuration, and every tracing packet you will do through the Hyper-V virtual switch and whatever extension you're using will be much easier to read to solve if you got some issues with it. And then the last thing about networking is they have now released something which is called the Windows Server Gateway. And what it is, it's actually a template. It's a virtual machine software router that you can deploy and it allows the network traffic routing between your virtual network. Do we have some changes on clustering? Yes, we do. I already talked briefly about it. One of the things is shared virtual hard disk. It doesn't exist in Windows Server 2012, only in R2. And with this feature, you can use a VHDX file, only a VHDX file of course, as a shared storage for a virtual machine failover cluster. Now let me try to explain this a little bit more easier. Let's say we've got a Hyper-V cluster with, you know, 4, 5, whatever Hyper-V servers. And somewhere in that failover Hyper-V cluster, we've got 2 SQL servers which are deployed within a failover cluster as well. So we got a virtual Windows server, another virtual Windows server, both got SQL installed and they are installed as failover cluster. One of the things you can do now is use a VHDX and get all the advantages of that VHDX, like backup, like portability and those kind of things, and use it as your shared storage with that SQL server. I think that is really a very cool feature that can be used. Other things that have been changed is the virtual machine drain on shutdown. In 2012, when you as an administrator did the shutdown of your Hyper-V host and you forgotten by accident to put it in maintenance mode, then every virtual machine went to safe state and it took some time before it started on another host. Now it's been built in that if you do that by accident, then first all the virtual machines will fail over and then it will shut down. This is just to avoid, you know, human errors. And let's be honest, we all did this at least once, and I'm not going to say how much time I did this. Another thing is that a Hyper-V failover cluster could think that everything is okay, but in reality, there could be a virtual machine or virtual machines, multiple, that are suffering from network disconnection. Now, in R2, the failover cluster will actually detect that, and what will happen is that it will live migrate that virtual machine to a node where that specific network that that virtual machine needs actually is available and that he can reach. It required some CSV or cluster share volume improvement. There are optimized placement policies. There's an increased resiliency. I don't think I talked before about the cache allocation, but you can now allocate a higher percentage of the physical memory of a host to your CSV cache. It used to be a maximum of 20% of your memory. Today in R2 you can choose 80%. So that is pretty cool as well to improve IOPS and more on your CSV. It will be much more easier to troubleshoot CSV because PowerShell now allows you to better troubleshoot on your CSV. And there are some changes because CSV now supports REFS, data deduplication as I already talked about, parity storage spaces, the tiered storage spaces which we talked about, and that write-back caching within those storage spaces. Pretty cool. We will have less dependency on Active Directory. Deploying a failover cluster without dependencies actually in Active Directory domain services is now possible. This means you can deploy a cluster, but the only thing you need to remember is that the cluster network name and the network names for any of your clustered roles need to be registered within DNS. And what won't happen anymore is there won't be any computer objects created within Active Directory. So the CNO or the cluster name object and the VCO or the virtual computer objects are not created in AD. Of course, this still remains an option that you have to choose. Some improvements on the quorum. There are some improvements to dynamic witness. There are some use interface improvements. We now have something which we call a tiebreaker for 50% node split, so we don't have those issues anymore that, you know, you've got this split and nobody knows who's the boss. So also some big improvements on that one if you're using quorums. There's a difference in the heartbeat failure. By default in 2012, this is 5 seconds. If you get over those 5 seconds, then the cluster will say, hey, I'm unhealthy. That has been changed. If your cluster is within the same subnet, then now the heartbeat failure will be 10 seconds. If it is in different subnets, then it will be 20 seconds. In Windows Server 2012 R2, you can turn off IPsec or Internet Protocol Security for your inter-node cluster communication. Now, I don't think that is actually a good idea, but imagine that you have something like high latency group policy updates, then it could be resolved by putting it on IPsec off, otherwise your cluster will go in a failure. But if you don't suffer from those issues, I don't think it's a good idea to turn off IPsec on your inter-node cluster communications. And the last update to failover clustering is kind of a cosmetic update. For many people, it will be a very useful update because now you will have a cluster dashboard and then you will see immediately how the health of your cluster or clusters, if you got multiple, is. And then we're going to talk Hyper-V. Shared virtual hard disk, we already talked about it. Other thing is resizing virtual hard disks. Now this is not new, you could do this already. But now you can do this while the virtual machine is actually running. But if you want to do that, then you have to remember that you have some requirements for this. The disk must be in VHDX format, can be a fixed disk, differencing disk, or dynamic disk, and it must be connected to a SCSI controller as well. A complete new feature for Windows Server 2012 R2 is called Storage Quality of Service, or Storage Costs, and this gives you the possibility to specify a maximum IOPS value for a virtual hard drive. And yes, you read that correctly. That means it can be a hard drive. It doesn't have to be an entire virtual machine. It can be a hard drive. And this, of course, gives you the possibility to right size your environments or just to make sure that a single virtual server cannot take all the IOPS that it wants to take. We already talked about live migrations a bit. You can now define your live migrations depending on the infrastructure. We talked about it that you can choose SMB now. But if you prefer to use compression for your live migrations, meaning you're compressing your virtual machine first before you're sending it over to save on bandwidth, you can choose that protocol, or you can choose the standard TCP as well. Pretty cool now is that if you are ready to deploy 2012 R2 and you have some shiny new service running in your environment, the downside always used to be that if you want to migrate your older virtual machines from Windows Server 2012, or in case of 2008 to 2012, that they had to be shut down, migrated, and then started. Now you can live migrate from 2012 to 2012 R2 without downtime. But don't forget, you cannot downgrade anymore. So don't do this as a test and then go back, because that won't work anymore. Another new thing is something called virtual machine generation. Every virtual machine you're running today is called a generation 1 virtual machine. But starting from R2, you can choose whenever you create a new virtual machine to have a generation 2 virtual machine. That means no more BIOS-based firmware. It will be using the UEFI firmware. And besides a different firmware, there's also the removal of the majority of every emulated device that you have. No more IDE, no more disk drive, no more things like that. This will result in faster boot times for your virtual machines, but also faster installation times. And I'm pretty sure that in the future we'll see more advantage. However, before you ask, no, you cannot convert the generation 1 to generation 2 and vice versa at this moment. So that is something you have to think about. There are some new things within the integration services. It's called guest services, and this allows your administrators or yourself to copy files to a running virtual machine even if that virtual machine doesn't have a network connection. So that is pretty cool. You can now also export the virtual machine or a checkpoint of a virtual machine while it's running, which, you know, wasn't possible before. So no more shutting down or pausing a virtual machine to get an export. You can do that live now as you wish. There's also something called enhanced session mode. And enhanced session mode is a new feature that gives you the similar functionality as a remote desktop connection. Today, when you use a virtual machine connection, what you get screen, you get keyboard, and you get mouse redirection. And that's it. With enhanced session mode, your virtual machine connection, you will get all the redirection capabilities, or almost all the redirection capabilities, without needing to do an RDP session to your server. Some changes to the Hyper-V replica, yes, of course. Now you can replicate a server from host A to host B, and from host B to host C, so you get an extended replication. And by default in Windows Server 2012, the frequency of replication was 5 minutes, which was fixed. And now you have the choice between 30 seconds, 5 minutes, and 15 minutes. There are also some changes to the Linux support. One of the things is that most Linux distros, or at least the newer distros, will now have updated integration services, and you will be able to use dynamic memory the same way as your Windows Server virtual machines can do. And the cool thing is, you don't need to pause your Linux machines anymore to take a backup, because that can be done the same way as your Windows Server machines as well. What else is new? Management. Those who were working in an environment with different versions of Hyper-V, they know they had to have the multiple consoles just to be able to manage it. But with the Hyper-V manager in Windows Server 2012 R2, you can now manage your R2 hosts and your 2012 host as well. And this will count for Windows 8.1 as well, if you're running that Hyper-V manager on your Windows 8.1. And then probably one of my favorite new features is something called Automatic Virtual Machine Activation, or AVMA. And if you buy a Windows Server Data Center Edition license, then you know you can install it as a Hyper-V host, and every virtual machine running on that host is automatically licensed. Now, it used to be so, of course, that, well, you still had to activate all those virtual machines anyway. With AVMA, that can be done for you. So what will happen is a virtual machine starts, it will bind itself to the Hyper-V host, and if that host is licensed with the right licenses, then it will activate the virtual machine automatically when it starts. So pretty cool. Now let's have a look at the enhancements on remote desktop services. One of the things that now exists, which existed of course in Citrix for a long time ago, is something called session shadowing. Well, R2 brings that to RDS as well. What else? We already talked about the online storage deduplication when you use VDIs or something. But there's also some improved remote app behavior. Now, remote app comes closer to the real deal. What I mean by that is that the look and the feel of those applications that are running on an RDS host are going to act exactly the same as the applications like they would be installed locally. That includes the support for transparency, live thumbnails, seamless application moves, and you know, this might not sound like a big deal to us as IT administrators, but for the end user, this is a very, very big deal. One of the other items that sometimes caused some frustration with your end users was the time necessary to reconnect to VDIs, session-based desktops, or remote app programs. Now, with Quick Reconnect, it improves the performance for reconnecting and the connection process for remote app, which has been completely redesigned in Windows 8.1 and within 2012 R2. As of today, I do not know if those updates for the clients will come to older versions as well. Today, I only know they are running in Windows 8.1 and Windows Server 2012 R2. There's a huge difference on bandwidth usage. Microsoft has been using now a lot of different codecs that have compression, which gives you a lot of saving on bandwidth. And that will make sure that the experience is much better for your end users. For example, if you look at the video content, first, it doesn't use TCP/IP anymore, but it will use UDP. And second, because of the codec changes, you will save up to 50%, according to Microsoft, on your bandwidth. Dynamic display handling is pretty cool. From the moment you have your remote app open and you switch your tablet or your computer or you attach a new monitor or maybe even a beamer or something, then it will be reflected on that remote application immediately. So it will know that something has changed and will adapt itself. And finally, your remote FX virtualized GPU now supports DX11.1. Now I had to do my research on that one, and this is very important if you're running games, but I'm hoping or guessing you're not running games as a remote app, but also if you are using vector-based applications, then it will improve that as well. Now what are the changes within PowerShell? One of the biggest is something called desired state configuration. And this is something within PowerShell 4, because Windows Server 2012 R2 brings us PowerShell 4. And that enables the deployment and management of configuration data for software services. Now let me try to give you a simple example for that, because the first time I read that, it was like, what does it mean? Now, if you're using or have been using System Center Configuration Manager 2007 R2, you'll probably have somewhere, yes, desired state configuration, I know that. Well, it's actually that, but now in PowerShell. So let's take, for example, that we have somewhere a server, and the desired state configuration of that server is that it runs IIS, that it's got a folder called C backup, maybe even a folder called C data. Now, what PowerShell will do with desired state configuration, it will monitor that, and from the moment it sees that you're out of desired state, it will fix that through some PowerShell workflows. So pretty cool stuff we have within PowerShell, and certainly something to look at for the future. Alright, what else? Safe help. I like this. It's a very handy new feature. One of the things that bothered me most in the past was that you need to have a connection to the internet to download the help information for the PowerShell modules. Now, certainly if you want to start it the first time. Now the problem with me was that I had to work a lot on servers which, well, have no internet. So I couldn't download those help files, and I'm one of these guys that uses get help a lot. Now with Safe Help, I can save all that information, on my local computer and then take it with me to those servers to be able to use that as well. Pretty cool as well. The Windows PowerShell debugger has been enhanced as well. Debugging PowerShell workflows and scripts that are running on remote computers is now possible. Now this can be done from the Windows PowerShell command line, but also if you're using the Windows PowerShell Integrated Scripting Environment or ISE. And a pretty cool thing is if your remote session for some reason disconnects and you are reconnecting, then your remote debugging session will be preserved and will still be running. So very cool. And then of course some additional bug fixes, some enhancements, some new commands as you can expect with every new version of PowerShell. We're going to talk about Windows deployment services very shortly, because what has changed? Well, nothing, besides that everything now can be managed through PowerShell support. So that is pretty easy and pretty short to talk about. And the last thing I want to talk about today is about directory services and security. What changes do we have there? A single sign-on. Yes, I know this is a technique that, you know, we already know for a long time when we talk about computers that are joined within a PC domain, but with Windows Server 2012 R2, that technique will be brought as well to those workplace joined devices, which I talked about in the beginning of the presentation. As we discussed in the introduction, our workforce today is very mobile. They want to work from anywhere. They want to work from home, hotels, airports, somewhere very close to a washing machine or something like that. But you still need access to the corporate data and your applications. Today you have technologies like VPN, direct access, remote desktop gateways, and many more. In Server 2012 R2, is something new, which is called a web application proxy. And that is something that will allow you to publish enterprise line of business web applications so they can be accessed from outside of your corporate network. And this role is actually an extension for the Active Directory Federation services proxy. So that means that you will be able to use it with Federation services as well. Multi-factor authentication, it already existed, but now it's just much easier to implement within Windows Server 2012 R2. And the cool thing now is there's a plugin model, so you can allow different multi-factor authentications within ADFS. So if you got other companies that have cool multi-factor authentications or very strict or specific ones, then you can actually use that now as a plugin within Windows Server 2012 R2. Multi-factor access control is completely new. It gives us, IT professionals, the possibility to create application-specific access control policies based on various and multiple criteria. And you can create those criteria based on things like user identity, device identity, location, are you within the intranet, are you at the extranet, and much more. So now you can actually say, you know what, you are allowed to my application, but if you are near that washing machine or at the airport, I'm very sorry, but you don't get any access at that moment. Then OAuth, which is an open standard for authorization, 2.0 has been released to Windows Azure Active Directory. Now this is in 2012 R2 as well. Now for those who are not certain what it is, it provides a method for clients to get access to things or resources on servers on behalf of a resource owner. Now what is a resource owner? That could be a different client, that could be a end user. And it also provides a process for those end users to authorize third-party access to those specific resources without the need of typing in, you know, username and password or something like that. On the thing about security, there are a lot of changes and improvements to AppLocker, BitLocker, TPM, TLS, SSL, and so on. And one very cool one, if you're deploying Windows Server 2012 R2 Core, which I really, really like, and really like to push as well to IT administrators to save on resources, but now by default, Windows Defender will run on that core and is enabled. And then some smaller changes on your group policy as well. You will have now support to create group policies on printer settings, item level targeting, and VPN connection for IPv6 addresses, something which wasn't possible before. There are more event logging details to your group policy as well. And there's also something now called policy caching, which means that the policy will be downloaded to a local store on your computer or server. And if there are no changes with the local store and the one running on Active Directory or on the domain controllers, then it will use the one from the local store, which will allow your computer or your server to start up more quickly. All right. And with that, thank you very much again for joining me on this session. And hopefully we'll see you soon at one of our other webinars. Have a great evening, have a great afternoon, or have a great day if you're still starting. And see you all next time. Goodbye.